deserves to be studied and understood, because it, although probably you've never heard of it because we introduced it, it appears in quite a few places in fundamental physical theories. And in fact, I'll show you today, and the structure is area matrix. And today I will show you that with these area matrix, you can actually do gravity with quite surprising results. So this is work done in collaboration with Matthias Wohlfahrt in Hamburg and my former research student, Raffaele Punzi. So let me just start by giving you straight the rules for this structure. So the structure we call an area metric manifold, or more precisely an area metric spacetime as we will use it. And in fact, it's a smooth manifold M, and we equip it with a tensor of the fourth rank, which we call the area metric. And this area metric is defined by three properties. Namely, it has a certain symmetry property, meaning if you take pairs of indices and you exchange them, AB against CD, nothing changes. There's an anti-symmetry property. If within one of these pairs you switch indices, you pick up a minus sign. It's of course also true because of the first property. This is also true for the second pair. And finally, there is an invertibility condition. Namely, we require that there exists an inverse to this area metric, which we denote by indices up. And so you take G up AB MN, and you sum over MN with G down MNCD, and what you get is, or what we require you get is 4 times delta AC delta BD, but with AB antisymmetrized. So this is a kind of like a multiple of the identity on the space of dual two forms, if you want. So this is a very simple structure, and well, once you have it, you can check that you immediately get a volume form from this, namely by grouping these two pairs of indices into a six, well, if we were in 4 dimensions, this antisymmetric pair, there are of course 6 antisymmetric pairs, so it's like a 6x6 matrix in higher dimensions correspondingly, and you take kind of the big determinant, so this is kind of the Petrov notation, and this really transforms like a density of weight 1 if you take this power there, and so we can integrate on these manifolds, we have a Hodge dual and so on. So this is first of all an abstract structure, and you can define a lot of things. Well, you know this structure, you've seen things like this before. For example, if you take a metric manifold, you can immediately induce from a metric an area metric. So you have GAC GBD minus GAD GBC, and well, the determinant, the big determinant, is determinant of small g to the d minus 1, and if you plug that in up here in the canonical volume form, you get the familiar square root of the determinant of g factor. And if you now plug into this 4 tensor twice the same pair of vectors, xy, xy, what you obtain is the area squared of the parallelogram. And because of the anti-symmetry property, actually, you anti-symmetrize this xy, so it's actually an x wedge y. So in fact, you identify all SL2R equivalent coplanar parallelograms. So every metric manifold is an area metric manifold. So are area metric manifolds more interesting than metric manifolds? Well, in fact, yes, because area metrics present a refinement of metric geometry. Well, I have to qualify that statement a little bit. Let's look at various dimensions. Manifold of dimension 1, algebraic degrees of freedom of the area metric is of course 0. There are no area metrics in one dimension. No surprise. Dimension 2, you have 1 algebraic degree of freedom, G0101, that corresponds to a scalar density. So that's actually less than a metric. It's coarser than a metric. In 3 dimensions, an area metric has 6 algebraic degrees of freedom, and in fact it's true that in 3 dimensions an area metric is equivalent to giving a metric. You can understand this also from duality in 3 dimensions. If I give you a plane, you can immediately convert it to a vector. But, well, this can be shown more concisely. And actually in four dimensions, you have 21 algebraic degrees of freedom. So you see in four dimensions, an area metric has more information than a metric. And, well, for those of you who don't leave your offices very often, four dimensions is where we live. So, that should be of some interest. Now let's focus for that reason on four dimensions. And one interesting fact is if you assume that space-time is equipped with such an area metric and you pull it back to a three surface, there it looks like a metric. Okay? So, that's really conservative. So I showed you area metrics can be defined. Area metrics are more general than metrics, but you can define a lot of things. The question is this a natural structure? Is this just another structure for an encyclopedia? And in fact, area metrics emerge rather naturally in a number of contexts. So let me start with gauge theories, which, you know, they are the birthplace of the idea of a metric space-time structure. So you have the density, and in order to write your f-squared term, you need to lift the indices on one of the f's. And you do this, of course, explicitly with the inverse metric, but because the f is anti-symmetric, you get a term of the type gg minus gg, which is exactly the induced area metric for a metric. And so we can actually formulate, so what the gauge field sees in this action is just the induced area metric from a metric, but not the metric itself. So as I said, this is kind of interesting because one usually thinks historically this is the birthplace of a metric structure, but you can't really read it off there. And in fact, it shows that gauge fields can live quite naturally on generic area metric backgrounds because no one tells me I need to choose an area metric that comes from a metric. But the question is, do they have to live there? And in order to look at that, let's consider what we know quite well. Namely, we know that matter is not classical. We know matter is quantum. So let's take quantum gauge theory, let's say quantum electrodynamics. And let's also consider back reactions via Einstein's equation on a metric background. So assume everything is as we always thought, but then it has actually been calculated by Drummond and Hathwell that effective action to lowest order for this theory, which we expect. So if you do this on flat space, you get kind of tree-level diagrams and you get back classical Maxwell theory. But here what you get back in front of the FF term is a complicated combination involving the Ricci scalar, the metric, the Ricci tensor, and also the Riemann tensor. And this total object, in fact, cannot be thought to be generated from just a metric. This is truly area metric. So it seems like if we take quantum matter into account and its back reaction, the theory already tells us, well, even the classical theory sees something structurally more complicated than a metric background. So in that sense, we have an indication here that gauge fields must live classically on such a background. Well, so this is a down-to-earth argument. Let me tell you a less down-to-earth argument. It also emerges from string theory. So first of all, classical strings, they naturally live on such backgrounds because, you know, the action of a string is given by its area. And obviously, if you have in your target space an area metric, you can pull it back and you get an area. But quantum strings make this again necessary because, you know, they're, let's take the bosonic string, you get massless modes G, B, and phi, so a kind of metric, effective metric, a Neville-Schwarz-II form, and a dilaton, and these actually neatly combine into an area metric, so also quantitatively. And last but not least, D-brains, the Dirac-Born-Ilfeld action cannot be considered the volume form of a metric manifold or anything like this, but it's very well the volume form of an area metric manifold. So, because time doesn't permit, I'm not going into more detail there, but so the fact that this very simple structure quite naturally appears in interesting places, we took this as motivation to take area metrics seriously, to consider them as a structure in their own right, rather than being derived effectively, and to postulate that the space-time geometry is refined in the sense that space-time is an area metric manifold. Now, if you want to do, for example, gravity theory with that, we certainly need to study the differential geometry of that structure, and then we can do dynamics. That's what I'm going to outline. So, I mean, this is all technically involved, and I try to give you a taste of what's going on there. So, assume we take the manifold, we equip it with an area metric, and there's actually a hierarchy of structures induced from the area metric. Namely, the first thing that you can do, you see, in metric geometry, you learn everything about your manifold by probing it with geodesics. At least you learn a lot. One might think here that you learn about area metric manifolds by probing them with strings. Actually, in a very good sense, you learn half of what you want to know about your differential structure, but you learn all you want to know by probing these manifolds with gauge fields. So I don't bother you with the strings. And in fact, what you can study is the gradient of wave surfaces of Maxwell theory or any non-abelian gauge theory on these backgrounds, and you can actually define a Fresnel tensor, which is a totally symmetric tensor in four dimensions of the fourth rank, which actually encodes the cone structure, and that can look like this. There could be double cones. It can look even worse. There will be quartic surfaces. Anyway, this is an important structure that appears. But even more from this Fresnel tensor, you can actually even get a kind of effective metric, which I learned recently from Kirill Krasnov, has a lot to do with the Obanke metric. And of course, this metric that you extract has less information than the area metric in four dimensions. But if the area metric happened to be metric-induced, you recover that metric. Okay? And this metric is an important auxiliary object in our construction of curvature. I'll show that in a second. Via this metric, we can also give a good theory or useful theory of signature for these manifolds, and also the coupling of formulas comes from this metric. So how do you get a curvature for area metrics? Well, first of all, what you can do, you can construct a connection on the dual of two forms. And that goes like as follows. First of all, you have this hierarchy G goes to Fresnel tensor, goes to the effective metric. And once you have this effective metric, it of course gives you a Levi-Civita connection. But this doesn't have all the information you want, because the effective metric is just some aspect of the area metric. However, you can lift the Levi-Civita connection naturally on the dual of two forms, omega 2 star. But now any connection omega 2 star is of course the Levi-Civita connection plus some tensor, which in this case is a tensor of the fifth rank. And this one you can uniquely determine by requiring that your connection is area metric compatible, which is of course has the same benefits as choosing your standard connection metric compatible in the standard case, but here it also ensures that simple two forms go into simple two forms under parallel transport. Anyway, we get by this a unique connection, and this connection on the dual of two forms gives us as the curvature tensor that's relevant here, a tensor of rank 6. Maybe that's just the tensor of that bundle. And by appropriate contractions, you can get something that has the structure of a Riemann tensor, a Ricci tensor, and a Ricci scalar, but they all come purely from the area metric. And again, if the area metric is metric-induced, everything reduces to the metric counterparts. Okay, so we managed in particular to write down a scalar curvature for an area metric background, a scalar curvature for this refined background. So now that we have that in place, we can say, aha, let's take the Einstein-Hilbert action, namely density and then the curvature scalar, and let's read it as an action for this refined structure, simply by putting the refined density in the refined curvature scalar. So this is clearly a new gravity theory because it is based on a new geometric structure. Note, there is no new scale that you have to introduce here. This is a structurally rigid extension. Whatever this theory gives you as predictions, you get numbers that only depend on your speed of light and your Newton constant, and of course the matter you put, but there's no scale to fiddle around with in order to make your results fit experiments. If this theory predicts the planets run in squares, then I think it's falsified. So the second thing is that this theory has second-order field equations. Well, this actually circumvents Lovelock's theorem, which tells you that other than Einstein-Hilbert plus maybe a cosmological constant, you cannot write down gravity theories with second-order field equations. But that's obviously based on the assumption that the background structure is symmetric. So what about solutions of this theory? Well, let's take metric gravity, Einstein gravity, and take vacuum solutions. Vacuum solution G. Well, I make out of this G, that is pattern GG minus GG, I induce an area metric, and it will solve the vacuum area metric gravity. Okay, so far so trivial. However, importantly, if you have matter solutions, say you have Einstein-Maxwell solution, and you lift this up as GG minus GG to an area metric, this will not solve, in general, the Maxwell theory on this generalized background. Okay, so this is, I summarize this here, like the back reaction that you get once you allow this finer geometry requires that the background is truly area metric. It's a little bit like you take electrodynamics on flat space that's consistent. At the moment you get the idea you should couple this to the background and you have back reaction, you know, because your electromagnetic field has energy, the background will be curved. Okay, and here it will even be area curved if you want. Okay, so this seems all natural, given that the structure naturally appears, but what about the predictions? Is this a theory that makes any sense? And really, I mean, the worst things could happen. So as always, the simplest thing to look at is cosmology, and symmetries, again, come from isometries, and they're infinitesimally encoded via Killing vectors, and in particular, we can impose homogeneity and isotropy. And what do we get? We get that of these 21 possible algebraic degrees of freedom, the area metric has this form. It is almost metric induced. It's of the form GG minus GG, where G is just an FRW ansatz, plus an extra term phi that comes in front of a volume form, and phi is an axial scalar. So that's the ansatz for cosmology. What's the matter we use for cosmology? Well, we would like to use a perfect fluid described by macroscopic variables density, rho, and pressure P. But in fact, on these manifolds, you can, as the minimal mechanical object, you need to use strains. And for the same reason, you cannot write down perfect fluids, which we think of constituted by pole particles. But in fact, in order to be inconsistent with isotropy, you need to take the three-component string fluid, which I'm not going to explain further, but it has three macroscopic variables, and of course one of the tasks is now to identify reasonable equations of state for these variables. So let's quickly look at the early universe, dominated by bosonic and fermionic radiation. You get from various considerations, which are very longish, I'm not telling you, you get equations of state, you plug this into these field equations, this is horrible, but everything reduces and you get precisely Einstein evolution for the metric that appears. Okay? So the early universe, miraculously, because this is a totally different framework, is entirely unchanged. Now the late universe, you have non-interacting string dust, you use from your diffeomorphism invariants, your conservation equations, etc. You identify corresponding equations of state for your string fluid, and what you get is an evolution that's qualitatively different from GR. I remind you, in GR you have these closed universes, the flat and the open ones, but all of them are non-accelerated, late universe. And you know, if you want an acceleration, you need to introduce a cosmological constant or some more exotic stuff even. But here, the solutions look like on the right-hand side, there's these two types of solutions that you have on the left-hand side qualitatively still exist, and there is an accelerated solution absolutely automatically without any further assumptions. This comes purely out of the refined geometry. So my conclusions, very quickly, is that area metrics refine metrics in more than four dimensions or equal four dimensions. They emerge, I haven't shown that to you in detail, but they emerge from the quantization of matter. And then you go back to the classical limit, and then effectively it looks like this matter lives on an area metric background. However, this is kind of phenomenologically, we then take the area metric as a structure in its own right, we develop this downwards compatible differential geometry, so metric geometry is contained, And we get Einstein-Hilbert, we can reinterpret the Einstein-Hilbert dynamics as dynamics for this refined structure without a new scale, so the predictions are rigid, and we circumvent Lovelock's theorem, and we get a small late-time acceleration, and small it is because it goes asymptotically to zero, which the natural mechanism to explain why it's so small, what we see, without having to introduce a small scale at some other stage in the theory. And we also did linearized, we solved the linearized equations for stationary spherical situations, on which of course our solar system tests are based. And again, miraculously, this is exactly like Einstein. So in cosmology and spherical symmetric situations, which are accessible, the theory only, although it's structurally very different, only where we need a new result, namely for the late universe, then the theory gives you a new result. And everything else, so far, is totally unchanged. Thanks.
Very nice. I have many questions.
Okay.
only one or two. If I get it right, there's no natural way to couple a point particle, right? Because you don't have it. There's no simple immediate.
No immediate way. Okay.
Right. So the question is, how do you get planets go around geodesics? For
yes.
Instance?
Yes.
Very That's the first question.
Very good question. So
thank you.
So in general relativity, we of course have this thing that we say, oh, light runs along null geodesics. And of course, this is true, but what you have to do to show this is you have to take Maxwell theory, you study wave propagation, and you study the geometric limit, and then you learn, aha, the gradients really are null. Okay? You do the same thing here, but here the structure that defines what is null is not the area metric, it's not the effective metric, it's the structure in the middle, this Fresnel tensor. Okay? This defines what's null. And so that's at the point, so to speak. But then you can differentiate this equation and do a few interesting things, and then you also get a differential equation for the propagation of gradients to the light fronts. Okay? And if you do this, what you get is you get geodesics in Finsler geometry, where Finsler geometry is the geometry where each tangent space is equipped with a norm rather than an inner product. And this norm is exactly defined from this four tensor, this Fresnel tensor. So for light, I can answer your question, but the next important question is, of course, what do planets do? And, you would have to start from fundamental matter in order to really give a deep answer to this. You could say, oh, these are the Fresnel geodesics that are not null, but that they're Fresnel positive or something like this. But I don't know whether that makes sense. But for light, we know what happens, and that's why I can confidently make these statements about cosmology, where, of course, we have our data from light.
Mm-hmm. More questions? I have a question about the degrees of freedom.
Yes.
The question about the degrees of freedom, I guess, also a two-part. Part A would be, when you calculate the propagating modes, is it just a spin 2, or would you have a monopole?
Yeah. It's
also part B, if I can squeeze that in, is if you wanted to extend the degrees of freedom, could you also include things like torsion?
Okay, so yes, that's a very important question with what the actual propagating degrees of freedom are, and that would correspond to another high-precision test, or, well, relative high-precision test we could do, and we're comparing to the binary pulsar, and what's radiated away. We haven't been able to do that yet. So that's very, very complicated. So the thing is, I mean, I presented to you here just the gist of it. The real complication comes because the space of areas at the point is not a vector space because of this SL2R quotient space. So that means your fundamental spaces you're interested in are not vector spaces, which means tensors being linear maps between linear spaces do not have this immediate predominant role they have in standard differential geometry where you measure lengths of vectors, of elements in a vector space. So all this gives you a lot of problems and makes this whole thing even at another level non-linear than GR is non-linear, okay? It's a totally different thing. And kind of all these technical complications go into the practicality of doing what you say, but I think it can be done and we're going to do it, but it's not so straightforward.
Yeah. You said that the dilaton metric and the B field of string theory combine neatly into this area metric.
Yes.
Now we know that in string theory, consistency requirements lead to the requirement that the metric has to satisfy Einstein's equations. So
yes.
If you say this fits so naturally together, does it also give you area metric gravity? Have you considered that question?
No, I haven't. We haven't considered that question. That's actually an interesting thing to do. What I know is what I don't know that worked very well, but Kirill Krasnov actually studied the renormalizability of gravity in the Blavatsky formalism, and he comes by adding terms he needs to add by his scheme. He comes to a theory which actually also leads to an area matrix. So it looks different. It has these has a family of true forms and so on, but they all make up an area matric. Okay. So from that direction, so that's a different direction from where you also come to an area matrix other than my observations. Oh, look, there is one and there is one and there is one. Okay. But the question of how that fits into this string argument is an interesting one, and we haven't done that.
Okay.